good evening again. For those of you who are new, and there are several here tonight for the first time, the past few weeks we have been looking at what we're calling the Dharma of relationships. Dharma, of course, being the teachings of the Buddha. But the word Dharma also means just the nature of being, the way things are. You know, the Buddha taught about the nature of being. So it has that double meaning. And sometimes it also is used in the plural, dharmas, meaning kind of manifestations. Like, each of you is a dharma. So you'll hear that word used different ways. But we're talking about the Dharma of relationships in the sense of how does this practice, how do these teachings support being in relationship, because we are relational beings. We can't, there's no way around that. We're social beings. We are made to be in relationship, and whether we like it or not, we are, not only with each other, with other human beings, but with all the plants and animals and elements that support our lives. It occurred to me when I was starting on this this week's talk that the Bodhisattva path is essentially a path of relationship. In essence, the Bodhisattva means awakened or awakening being. Bodhi is awakening or awakened. And a Bodhisattva is a being who vows to awaken for the benefit of all beings, not just for oneself. So a Bodhisattva recognizes that we only awaken from within a matrix of relationships. We can't awaken alone because we are essentially not alone. We're essentially not separate. On the other hand, no one else can do our practice for us. Right? We have to have that intention, make that vow ourselves to do the practice. We are each born as unique individuals, right? With genetic makeup unlike anyone else ever. Before or after. And we're born into a mix of environmental, familial, social, cultural, historical factors, right, that shape our development. So we are each and every one of us both the same and different in our nature and our nurture, right? All of us grew up in a family, went to a school, pretty much, I think. But our experiences varied greatly. Right. And that's partly what we enjoy about getting to know other people, right? Is because they're interested. It wouldn't be very interesting if they were all exactly like us. And yet, the differences also can be a challenge. They can make us uncomfortable. They can be quite threatening. I don't know about you, but I've noticed often in intimate couple relationships, we're attracted to someone who has some characteristics that are different from ours, right? Only to find out that those, some months along, that those very characteristics that we thought were so wonderful are starting to drive us nuts. What seemed like a kind of lively vivacity now seems like frantic playing to the crowd. What happened? What seemed like stability and calm now seems like stubborn withdrawal. What happened? Is that the same person? In our cultural marketplace approach to relationships, it's all too easy to get fed up and impatient and toss out a relationship and look for an upgrade. But have you ever noticed patterns in relationships? Have you ever repeated a pattern? And I'm not just talking about couple relationships, but friendships. We have a tendency to fall back on the familiar and keep trying to make it work, right? And blaming more often the other person than ourselves when it doesn't work. Bodhisattva practice, on the other hand, asks us not to turn away from what's uncomfortable or painful in ourselves or in others. Our bodhisattva vows ask us to look deeply into the roots of our suffering and see the causes and conditions that have led to this pain. And as we've already seen a couple weeks ago, we looked at how those causes and conditions kind of reduce down to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. Greed or clinging, hatred or aversion, pushing away what we don't want, and ignorance, I just don't want to deal with it, right? Looking away. And what we're looking away from is the reality of impermanence and no solid separate self. Those are the things we don't want to really believe. So we grasp on to our sense of self and to permanence. And then we all tend to externalize those characteristics that we don't like in ourselves and see them more vividly in others. I've found, how many are familiar with the concept of the shadow in Jungian psychology? Yeah, quite a few, but not everybody. I found it quite helpful as a way to look at the way that we split off the unacceptable parts of ourselves and project them onto others. Carl Jung said, we meet ourselves in 1,000 disguises along the path. A Jungian psychologist, David Rico, defines the shadow as the archetype of the unconscious that represents the feared, denied, unaddressed, forbidden, and excluded parts of ourselves. So there's two kinds of shadow, positive and negative. The negative shadow, he says, is composed of our own unacceptable and disowned defects that we strongly condemn in others. What we are conscious of in ourselves, what we are unconscious of in ourselves, we become emphatically conscious of in others. Does that make some sense? Yeah. So we end up saying things like, why are you so angry? I'm not angry. Or, you're so sloppy. Don't you care about our living space? That kind of thing. And we believe that's the truth of the situation. But as we've been learning, as we go through this inquiry into relationship, our point of view is always partial. It's always partial. It's always conditioned. And it's always subject to change. So we might, if we can bring awareness to that, we begin to open up to the other in a way that's less threatening, right? But the shadow doesn't just represent the negative qualities that we disown. It might also include positive qualities that we were not allowed to express, maybe in our growing up, in our family, or in our culture. So we project those qualities onto those that we admire, or idealize, or put on a pedestal, right? oh, she's so creative, I'm not creative. So that's another aspect of the shadow. That sometimes gets us into trouble when we don't see the full complexity of that person that we put on the pedestal, right? Because we've idealized, we've looked at that part of them that we won't allow in ourselves. It's good to be aware of the shadow side of your guru, or your teacher, or your best friend, or your partner. The shadow, the positive shadow, is composed of the good qualities hidden in us that we strongly admire or envy in others. We consciously respect in them what we inwardly disavow in ourselves. So in Buddhist thought, each of those three poisons, greed, hatred, and ignorance, has a transformed or a purified quality when it's free of that self-focus, that self-clinging. Greed opens into care and compassion. It's not just greed, you know, grabbing for what we want, but a care, desire. Sometimes greed is called desire, but it's desire freed from self-focus. So it becomes care. And aversion, free from self-focus, self-interest, becomes what's called discriminating wisdom. So clear seeing, right? We need that too. And ignorance, free from self-focus, becomes calm and equanimity, stability. So each of these qualities has a transform quality. So in the very same way, the negative shadow contains within it a seed of some positive energy, some quality or potential that actually we really need to bring forward in our lives. This is really interesting when you start looking at this. So the shadow has gifts to give us. So let's look at some examples. Think of a quality that really annoys you in someone else. Go ahead, somebody come up with one.
When somebody doesn't listen.
Yeah. When somebody doesn't listen. What quality would that be? What would you call that? Somebody who doesn't listen.
Maybe self-centeredness. Or, I guess I was thinking specifically of people that are very, a little too focused on themselves, and they might, if you're having a conversation, they might not really, they're waiting for you to finish saying what you're saying to say what they've already
to jump
thought.
In, yeah. So take that quality, and what can you find in that quality that perhaps you could manifest more, that you actually would wish to manifest more?
In the opposite direction of that, do you mean?
Not the opposite, but the less exaggerated, less extreme.
I think clarity.
Yeah.
I think there's a clarity there.
Yeah, a kind of clarity and confidence.
Yeah, they know what they're thinking, they know how they feel.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the example. Like, there's often something, if we look hard enough in that, you know, that thing that really bothers us about somebody else, we'll find something in us that that needs to come forward more in a certain way or be expressed and allowed. Yeah. Anybody have another one? Yeah.
People who are controlling.
Mm-hmm. So what would be the less exaggerated but valuable version of that? Yeah. Yeah. Kind of really standing up for your point of view.
Yeah.
For example. Yeah. Yeah. He's got a whole list of them. So I'll try you out on this one. I'm just looking down arbitrarily, and I find flattery. You know, this is not that common, but just imagine somebody that, you know, they're flattering to an annoying extent. But what's a more less exaggerated, but
recognizing.
Yeah, appreciating, expressing appreciation, recognition for something, quality you like in someone, you appreciate it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Says complimenting is the one he gives. Oh yeah, here's the controlling manipulativeness. So the quality, he calls it the unowned, the projected versus the unknown. It would be leadership. Yeah, leadership. Maybe you're not, you know, bringing forward your leadership qualities. Yeah.
Is there anyone about when they don't wash their dishes?
Okay. Laziness is listed. Well, I'm not seeing sloppiness. Okay, so what would you imagine lazy, just for, not that that's what it is, but yeah.
Being relaxed.
Yeah, easygoing, being more easygoing, relaxed. Yeah, yeah.
The ability to not care so much.
Yeah.
No, the laziness was what I was going
to yeah, that. Yeah. And but you kind of get the idea of it's really important, particularly when it's something that really bothers us, to take a look at, is there something in us that's not being fully expressed, that's not being, yeah, but in a wholesome way rather than that exaggerated way, you know, because sarcasm.
Lightheartedness.
Funny. Yeah. Wit is what he uses, which is not a very commonly used word, but just lightheartedness, funniness. Yeah. Playfulness. Yeah. So, you get the idea. So I'm going to switch now to another helpful concept that relates closely to this shadow side concept, and that's of something called the inner critic. And you can kind of imagine probably what an inner critic is because you more than likely have one or two. Yeah. There are all those voices who inside us that deliver the messages of judgment and criticism, right? And they're sort of the enforcer of the shadow. The inner critic says, who do you think you are? You can't fill in the blank, right? Don't you dare fill in the blank. You know, we each have our set of voices that tell us these things. On the other hand, for some, that degree of harshness directed towards the self is so actually obliterating and unbearable that habitually project the critic outwards, you know, on others, that judgment. On others. But those inner critic voices, when they come up in us, it's pretty much a sure sign that there's some shadow territory there to pay attention to. Something we're not acknowledging. The inner critic comes into being early in our lives when we receive messages from our family, our environment, messages that tell us parts of us are unacceptable. They're bad or shameful, not good enough. And when these messages come from people who are supposed to be, who we depend upon, right? Who are supposed to be taking care of us, whose goodwill is important to us, we create an inner critic to preempt those messages. Because if we can control ourselves and behave, if we can control our behavior, then we can avoid having those messages come at us. That's so the inner critic is really comes on board to protect us, but goes overboard. And you know, as we move into adult life, the inner critic is still trying too hard, and often inappropriately. But, as you may have noticed, ignoring the inner critic doesn't help. Fighting, arguing, wrestling with the inner critic doesn't help. They just push back or become more sneaky. You may have noticed this actually in your meditation practice. Have you noticed that? You know, you can have these wrestling matches sitting here unmoving on your cushion. You have interior wrestling matches. What disarms the inner critic is making their acquaintance. Listening to what they have to say, but not believing or identifying with it. Just listening. Like listening to a friend in a bad mood. It's not always easy. But taking that step back and using what we talked about, I think it was last week or the week before, that witnessing space. That was, you know, taking the seat of the witness with compassion and kindness. And you can listen to your inner critic. You might also actually try taking the inner critic's point of view and see how they're trying to, what their strategy is, what they're trying to protect you from. Though they're doing it in a very controlling and unkind way, more often than not. And then you can find your own, shift back to your own point of view, and find your own voice, and say, well, actually, thanks, but no thanks. I can handle this. I'm okay. You don't have to do that. You don't have to say that. So, for example, say you have a micromanaging boss, very anxious kind of person who has to micromanage all the time. And say, at the same time, you have an inner critic that's always telling you how incompetent you are. You're in over your head with this job. So you might have a little discussion with your inner critic and come to the point of saying, I realize you're just trying to protect me from this, from taking risks at work and getting in trouble with this boss, with my boss, but really, I really want to establish a good working relationship with this person. I feel there's potential there. And that my boss may actually respond well if I come forward a little more. So could you just step back and let me try this? You know, you can negotiate. You can negotiate with an inner critic. And they lose power when you do that. In a case like this, the gift from the shadow side is this invitation to come out from the shadow and claim your own competence and authority. In the Buddhist tradition, the inner critic appears in the figure of Mara. Mara is the demon tempter in the Buddhist tradition, the stories of the life of the Buddha, who, according to the legend, appeared to the Buddha, before he was the Buddha, he was Siddhartha Gautama. appeared, Mara appeared to him not only before his enlightenment experience, but now and then throughout his life. The first time in the suttas, the ancient text that Mara appears, Siddhartha is practicing extreme ascetic practices, starving himself and doing extreme kinds of breath control. And Mara shows up and says, well, why don't you just become a priest and get merit from doing all the standard prayers and rituals? Why go to all this trouble? And then later, when Siddhartha is decided to sit under the Bodhi tree and not get up until he has achieved awakening, Mara shows up again with beautiful dancing women to tempt him with desire, and then he sends his armies to attack Siddhartha with doubt and mockery. And he said, "Who do you think you are? You think you can be a Buddha? Look at my armies here to support me. Who do you have? Who do you have as your witness?" And the Buddha made this beautiful gesture that you see in some of the paintings and statuary, the beautiful gesture of touching the earth and saying, "The earth is my witness. The earth is my witness." And then this earth goddess rose up out of the earth, and she wrung out her wet hair, and the water washed away Mara's armies. That's how it went. But how many of us do that, you know, in one way or another, touch the earth when we're needing that support, when we're needing the witness of the earth to help us through a rough patch, go into the forest, or sit on the earth? I do, right? I'm sure many of you do. But even later in the Buddha's life, after his enlightenment, and this is what's comforting to me, Mara would still show up. The Buddha lived in unstable times, just as we do. And he tried, at one point without success, to prevent a war between his family clan and another family clan. And there was tremendous loss of life and suffering. And Mara would show up and say, "Well, what use are you? You would have been better off to be follow in your footsteps and be a great king. You would have had more power to do good. And you would have been a lot more comfortable." And even at the very end of his life, when the Buddha was very ill, Mara showed up and said, "Oh, you know, you're tired. Haven't you done enough? Just go ahead, let go." And the Buddha said, "No, not yet. I must prepare my sangha to continue after I'm gone." And each time in these exchanges, the Buddha would meet Mara head on and simply say, "I see you, Mara. I see you." And Mara would kind of shrink away, and slip off. So we all have our Maras, our demon Maras, right, who tempt us with the inner voices of desire, resentment, envy, regret, self-doubt, self-disparagement, distrust, discouragement, all the things we'd rather disavow. Especially if we are aspiring Buddhas. It's really embarrassing, isn't it? But if we make the acquaintance of our Maras, even befriend them with some patience, some kindness, sometimes some tough love, like enough, he or she or it can show up and we can say, like the Buddha, "I see you. I see you, Buddha. Oh yeah, I remember you. I see you." And towards the end of the Buddha's life, these encounters almost seem like they're old friends. "Oh yeah, hi, it's you again." So that your demon, your Mara, your inner critic can actually become your ally. "Oh, a reminder, pay attention. Look more deeply. Open your heart. They can become your ally. Really, Mara cannot exist without Buddha, and Buddha cannot exist without Mara. Buddha's teacher named Stephen Batchelor wrote a book.
Living with the Devil.
Living with the Devil, thank you. And he said, Buddha needs to let go of Mara in order to be Buddha. And not just once, as an episode in a heroic drama of enlightenment. As long as Buddha lives, he is constantly relinquishing Mara. For Mara is the self to Buddha's selflessness, the fear to Buddha's fearlessness, the death to Buddha's deathlessness. The two are inseparable. Nirvana and samsara, light and darkness, there really can't be one without the other. So if even the Buddha was accompanied by Mara, his shadow, all his life, maybe we better learn how to live with Mara. And the best way is to do what Buddha did, to meet Mara, to meet our shadow, see him or her or it clearly, not to suppress the arisings of Mara, because it doesn't really work, but to sit steadfast, in body and mind and penetrate Mara's delusion of the permanent solid self. You don't need to hate Mara. You don't need to disparage yourself for being vulnerable to Mara. You don't need to suppress, dispel, avoid, deny, analyze. Don't need to analyze. Or distract yourself. Or to melodramatically indulge. Or to mindlessly vent. You just need to apply patience and kindness to these appearances, these arisings. And allow them to subside, to shift, to open, and disperse in the light of awareness. And this practice of befriending, being in relationship to your own shadow side, will for sure give you compassionate insight into the shadow side of others and transform your relationships. So, I thought, how's our time? We have time. I didn't get the paper and pencils. Could some person or persons please quickly distribute?